It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where we have a few clouds, 51 degrees, north winds to 9 miles per hour, 10 miles of visibility out at the airport. The Weather Service is calling for partly sunny skies for the rest of the day with northwest winds to 15 or so. For tonight, cloudy skies with a 20% chance of rain, low around 36. And for tomorrow, cloudy skies with a 30% chance of rain, high near 45, north winds to 5. However, starting on Saturday, sunny conditions. Saturday and sunny. Sunday, both mostly sunny. Coming up on the Midday Report, regulators are looking at radical harvest strategies for the Western Arctic caribou herd, which continues to decline. Juneau homeowners who were affected by the glacial outburst flood are finding out they're not covered by regular insurance. And ore trucks.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden plans to speak directly to the American people tonight about why he believes it's in the U.S.'s national security interest to bolster wartime aid to its allies, Ukraine and Israel, now. NPR's Asma Khalid has more on the rare primetime address the president plans to make from the Oval Office.
This speech comes after a high-stakes trip the president took this week to Tel Aviv. While he was there, he said he intends to ask Congress for a, quote, unprecedented aid package for Israel. Biden is expected to ask for billions of dollars of additional funding, not just for Israel, but also for Ukraine and other priorities. Some Republicans have been reluctant to continue funding the war in Ukraine. Tonight, Biden has a chance to both lobby lawmakers and make his pitch directly to the American public. One ongoing challenge, though, is that the House of Representatives remains in disarray, with Republicans unable to agree on a new speaker. And until that's resolved, it's not clear how any spending bills can be passed. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
On the ground, long lines of trucks are waiting in Egypt to carry humanitarian aid into Gaza. The enclave has been under a complete Israeli blockade for nearly 2 weeks. NPR's Jackie Northam reports from Jerusalem. Shipments of food, water, and medicine are expected to cross the border tomorrow.
Hundreds of tons of humanitarian aid has been stuck near the Rafah crossing on the Egyptian side for more than a week. Egypt kept the border shut for security concerns, and Israel has been launching airstrikes near the crossing. On Wednesday, President Biden said he secured an agreement with Israel to allow the aid into Gaza. He later told reporters that it'll take some time to repair the roads near the border, which have been damaged by airstrikes, and get UN personnel in place to organize the shipments. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Developments on the ground in Gaza and Israel adding to pressure on members of Congress to act. But as we heard a short time ago, the House's GOP majority is at an impasse over the election of someone to replace former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who was recently ousted. Ohio Republican Jim Jordan wants the job, but so far he's been unable to secure enough votes to make it happen. NPR's Susan Davis reports Jordan says he will seek a third round of balloting.
Initially, Jordan indicated that he would not seek a third ballot and instead back a resolution to expand the powers of Speaker Pro Tem Patrick McHenry. Under current House rules, McHenry can only preside over the election of a speaker, and no legislation can pass until that happens. But the proposal was met with fierce resistance, and so Jordan switched gears again.
We decided that wasn't where we're going to go. I'm still running for speaker, and I plan to go to the floor and get the votes and win this race.
It's unclear when the House will vote. Jordan says he first wants to speak with the 22 Republicans who opposed him on the second ballot.
This is NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. The slow uphill speed of Manh Cho mine ore haul trucks is a safety concern. That was one of the issues highlighted by a state-contracted engineer, Randy Kinney, at a Department of Transportation Roads and Highways Advisory Board meeting this week.
Even when you encounter mild grades with these B trains, they immediately begin to decelerate.
Kinney said the fully loaded 95-foot-long double-trailer ore haul rigs, known as B-trains, can slow significantly on uphills.
For example, for a 3% grade, that B-train, over if it was a sustained grade, is going to eventually be unable to go faster than 28 miles an hour.
Kinney said speeds slower than 10 miles per hour below the speed limit are considered a safety issue.
And it is actually something that contributes to crashes.
Kinney said the focus is on stretches of the 250-mile ore haul route along the Alaska, Richardson, and Steese highways with northbound uphills where truck climbing lanes or slow vehicle turnouts could help alleviate the problem.
We found that for that 250 miles route, we probably ought to look at about 20 miles of truck climbing lanes along there. But it's not cheap. It's $20 million to $50 million, depending on how they build the roadways.
Kinney also listed some less expensive options to address the slow speed issue.
They can reduce payload so that they have better performance on grades. They could have a policy that requires B-trains to pull over and let followers pass. One of the big things that I think they're going to implement is policy that prevents B-trains from platooning or traveling together along the highway so that they don't bunch up.
Kinney's company, Kinney Engineering, is contracted by the State Department of Transportation to work with the agency and a Transportation Advisory Committee to help develop an Alaska-Richardson-Steese Highway Corridor Action Plan. The plan, with a range of safety improvement recommendations for the ore haul route, is expected out by this year's end. For Juneau homeowners who were affected by August's glacial outburst flood, recovery aid from familiar safety nets like insurance and federal and state government has fallen short of expectations. While some state disaster aid is available, members of one Juneau Homeowners Association discovered they're not eligible for it. Now they're taking on more than $1 million in repairs on their own. KTOO's Anna Canny has the story.
This summer's record-breaking glacial outburst flood nearly sent a condo building on Riverside Drive into the Mendenhall River. The morning after the disaster, John Dietrich, treasurer of the Riverside Condominium Homeowners Association, saw the building hanging over the edge of the riverbank, and he called a meeting of the HOA board.
It seemed very precarious where it was sitting. So we acted immediately, and we authorized emergency use of our reserves, which was never intended for something like this.
Money collected from residents for routine maintenance like trash pickup or the occasional paint job became a disaster relief fund instead. There was enough money to stabilize the precarious building, but that was just a fraction of the necessary repair work. The building needs a new foundation, and erosion left three more buildings vulnerable to future floods. The cost to fix those things is estimated at more than $1 million, but for residents of the condos, recovery aid has fallen short of expectations. FEMA denied disaster aid for flood victims in Juneau. Insurance companies denied their claims, too. And though a state disaster declaration freed up some money, Riverside condo members aren't eligible for it. That's because the way Alaska state law treats HOAs is incompatible with the way state aid is distributed.
You're stuck paying, but you can't put your hat out for some more money.
That was a surprise to Brenna Heights. She hasn't been able to get into her unit on the top floor of the damaged building since the flood. But when she applied for disaster assistance from the state, she was denied. State assistance can help to cover repair costs for property that's damaged in a natural disaster. But the state told Heights that the damage to her building was not her responsibility.
It's the HOA's responsibility. But in order for them to fix that, they need money. And that comes from us, the owners. And I am not eligible for homeowners aid, even though that money is coming out of my pocket.
Under state laws, the HOA is treated more like a nonprofit business than a group of individuals. So residents like Heights can't access most forms of individual state aid. Alaska state law also requires that homeowners associations share responsibility for common elements. In this case, that's all of the Riverside condo buildings. So even though most of the 9 condo buildings were untouched by the flood, all 51 homeowners are on the hook for repair costs, more than $20,000 per person.
I was naive about the actual amount of money it would take. You know, the first few days after, it was just total shock.
Heights and some of her neighbors are relying on donations from family, friends, and the community at large. Heights' post-flood GoFundMe raised just enough money to cover her share of repairs. Without those donations, Heights said she would have had to take out a private loan. And that's what many in the undamaged buildings are doing. Other owners, like Joanna Forst, took money out of their savings accounts. Forst owns a unit in an undamaged building that sits along the riverbank, which she rents out. She said that her obligation to pay the cost of repairs came as a shock at first.
That's a lot of money out of everybody's pocket, yet that's what I signed into, and that was a hard pill to swallow.
Forst was able to make the payment in full, but as a stay-at-home mom, she said that money was an important supplement to her husband's income.
My spending has basically been cut to absolutely no spending.
In the end, she said repair work felt like a worthy investment to protect her unit from future flooding. According to Dietrich, about 3/4 of Riverside condo residents have already made their payments, while the rest try to figure out how to come up with the money. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
The Western Arctic caribou herd continues to decline, and regional subsistence managers are proposing emergency actions to dramatically reduce harvest limits. The Northwest Arctic Subsistence Regional Advisory Council decided on Monday to table proposed changes until their next meeting. But as KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports, the council understands that drastic changes are needed to protect the future of the herd.
Recent numbers show the Western Arctic herd has dropped by more than 10,000 caribou since last year. That's just the latest in a long-term decline over the last 20 years. The recent population estimate puts the herd numbers down to more than a third of the peak in 2003. The caribou decline prompted the Northwest Arctic Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, a group that advises the federal board, to propose emergency measures earlier this year. The emergency action would limit the current harvest of 5 caribou per day to 4 per year. Michael Kramer has been a member of the council for over a decade and favors the proposed changes.
We've got to preserve what we have. This caribou herd has continually declined from 20,000 to 10,000 animals per year. What are we going to have at 5 years from now? Without these caribou, our culture is gone. We need to look at starting to protect these animals now.
Biologists say climate change is a major factor in caribou decline for the Western Arctic herd. Increased insect populations in the summer drive the herds to migrate away from their feeding grounds and prevent them from foraging enough food for the winter. And warmer winters have meant their ground has been frozen in ice, which blocks access to the caribou's winter food sources. Helen Cold is a resource specialist for the Division of Subsistence and the lead on a 2-year harvest assessment of the herd. She says those changes in caribou behavior are also starting to affect the people that hunt them.
Warming temperatures and changes in precipitation are changing subsistence by making travel over ice less safe than it was in the past.
Tristan Patti lives in Ambler, a community about 120 miles from Kotzebue, and is on the Regional Advisory Council. He says the herd's migration patterns have also changed. Now caribou are spending more time farther north, which makes it harder for hunters to travel.
Right now, the caribou are very, very inaccessible to a lot of places. They're basically regulating themselves. I mean, people are not able to get them.
A change in seasonal migration means that many of the caribou bulls are now going into rut when they are accessible. When male caribou are in rut, some hunters have called the meat stinky and harvest females instead, which some biologists say may contribute to the decline. Patti criticizes the harvest limits, though. He says because the herd's range passes through several game management areas, including the North Slope and the Seward Peninsula, more consultation is needed before harvest should be limited.
I think this is the wrong time. I think we need to spend time consulting with different people, different areas, different game units to come up with a solution that will better fit everybody's needs.
The Regional Advisory Council acknowledged that many individual hunters share their harvest among their community. The council voted to table the change of the harvest limit from 5 caribou per day to 4 caribou per year until their next meeting in the spring. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the country, third highest in the nation, according to the CDC. And it can be one of the hardest things to talk about. People often feel a sense of shame or taboo. But awareness is shifting. KUCB's Andy Lusk has this story about an event in Unalaska where community members put taboo talk right out on the table.
How would you react if a friend told you they were considering suicide? Have you ever been too scared to ask for help with substance misuse? M. Lynn Crane knows these are difficult conversations to have. And that's why she thinks they're so important.
So the point of the table is really to facilitate having difficult conversations.
Crane is the executive director of Unalaskans Against Sexual Assault and Family Violence, or USAFE, a local crisis intervention, safe center, and advocacy organization. USAFE hosted their annual Make a Difference dinner for suicide prevention and awareness in late September, where Crane led a table designed specifically to have difficult conversations.
We write out prompts. We talk about it. We write out prompts for different age groups, and we ask people to draw one and read it, and then tell us how they would help a friend who was dealing with that situation.
When I pulled a difficult conversation topic, I got one about the pandemic.
I just drew a slip, and it reads, I know some people say the pandemic is over, but I just don't seem to be able to get back to my old self. I feel different, and like things will never be good again. So am I speaking as myself, or a friend just told me this?
The way I approach it is I ask you to tell me what you would say to a friend, and the reason I do that is because I think maybe it makes it a little easier to talk about, like how you would help someone else, but you can do it however you want. It's not my job to tell you how to do this.
I said this almost verbatim myself.
About 10 community partner groups teamed up with USAFE to host different activities. There was yoga, painting, and games. Lots of positive activities for such serious topics. In fact, many people look forward to the annual event, which had to take a pause during the pandemic. Longtime Unalaska local Susie Golodoff says it's one of her favorite events of the year. Like most of the attendees, Golodoff traveled from table to table, checking out the different groups.
Been to all of them yet. I'm only on number 3, so I've still got a ways to go. Yeah, I'm traveling around.
One of the tables offered a quiz about LGBTQ rights. I thought I knew the issues pretty well, but I was surprised to have missed a few questions. The table's hosts, Russell LaForteza and Ivana Rupidiaz, said that's kind of the point. We may think we know an issue inside and out, but that's not always true. But the bigger takeaway from their table is that the backing of the community can alleviate the stigmas of being LGBTQ.
So it is very important to host a table to serve as a reminder that the LGBT community is just as normal as the rest of us, and no one should be marginalized because of their sexuality or gender identity.
In general, LaForteza and Rupidiaz agree that Unalaska is a welcoming place.
We know mostly everyone around here, so we feel safe at all.
Yes, yeah, yes. I know everyone, and vice versa. So I've been very feel welcome here.
Another table focused on indigenous knowledge and tools for healing. And Fisha Tudiakoff is the culture director for the Kawalungan tribe. To her, engaging in art is a way to connect with her culture.
The Onanga, the Aleut people, we've been so impacted by, you know, our history. And so we really have to work through all of that and reclaim who we are traditionally and historically and bring back and revive our culture and traditions. You know, if we don't have that, we feel lost.
Tudiakoff reflected on the importance of traditional healing practices while decorating stones from Unalaska beaches with Unungan traditional markings.
When we talk about traditional healing, we really want to embrace our culture, you know. We need to know who we are internally through our ancestors and, you know, being able to not only share our own culture and history, but learn about others.
And it's not only Alaska Native culture that uses art to heal. Local artist Sharon O'Malley led a painting station where visitors used markers and watercolor paint to create colorful, abstract patterns on small sheets of paper.
You can be 5 years old or 85 years old and still get the same enjoyment out of it. It's relaxing, and the colors make me really happy. Just looking at bright colors really works for me. Anyway, I think it's really fun, and I think art is a great way to deal with stress. Yeah, for me it is anyway.
Crane says it's a fun event about a serious topic. She stresses how important it is for the community's youths to see leaders at events like this. In all, about 130 turned out for the event, including members of city council and community leaders from all across Unalaska. If you or someone you know is in crisis or thinking about suicide, help is available. Call or text the Suicide Crisis Lifeline at 988. Help is available 24/7. Just call or text 988. In Unalaska, I'm Andy Lusk.
A new report estimates that almost all of Earth's surface-level permafrost could disappear by the year 2100 as climate change continues to warm the atmosphere. That has hefty price tag consequences for Alaska, Alaska Public Media's climate reporter Kavitha George reports.
There's already 8 inches of snow on the ground in Fairbanks, but you won't find any surrounding permafrost expert Vladimir Romanovsky's house.
In my house, it's right on the boundary between permafrost and non-permafrost, and I don't know exactly.
Snow is an insulator. It keeps the ground several degrees warmer than the air, and Romanovsky wants to keep this ground cold. If there is permafrost below his house, he doesn't want to risk it thawing and potentially cracking the foundation or creating other structural problems.
That's why, just in case, I'm shoveling snow around the house to make ground colder. And just in case, if there's some deeper permafrost there, and that will prevent it from thawing.
Permafrost is the frozen layer of ground on or just under the Earth's surface in polar regions. And Romanovsky is part of a team of international scientists who are trying to understand how quickly it's thawing. As the climate warms due to human-produced carbon emissions, the Earth's upper layers of permafrost are at risk of disappearing. The rate it thaws has enormous financial consequences for anyone living above permafrost now. The team modeled different scenarios of warming to see the effects on permafrost and published their findings last month. In severe warming scenarios, they found that more than 75% of Earth's near-surface permafrost will be gone by the end of the century. Even in more moderate warming scenarios, more than half will disappear. Romanovsky says based on the air temperature data they recorded, we're heading toward that severe warming scenario already.
We're kind of on the higher end of the predictions, the real changes in temperature.
That means three-quarters of the world's near-surface permafrost is set to vanish by 2100. This has major implications for cold climate regions like Alaska, where permafrost covers the majority of the state, and thawing is already well in motion. One of the biggest impacts is to the built environment. Buildings, homes, roads, and other infrastructure need stable surfaces to remain sturdy. But when the ground beneath is literally melting, those surfaces start to sink and become unstable. This is already a major problem for rural Alaska communities built on permafrost, and it's going to get worse.
Technology nowadays, you know, we can make it work, but it's going to be very, very expensive.
Dr. Joey Yang is a civil engineering professor at UAA. He studies solutions for building on thawing permafrost in places like Bethel, Nome, and Nukyagvik. Homes in these areas are often built on adjustable foundations that can be modified as the ground shifts below. Roads and other infrastructure require thermosiphons, big pipes that use cold surface air, or sometimes air conditioning units, to cool the ground below and keep it from moving. Yang says as permafrost thaw continues, these solutions will become more crucial and more costly.
I think as long as the climate is going the direction as it was predicted, this is just life as usual. We just have to deal with it.
Scientists say the only thing that could stop permafrost thaw is to significantly curb global carbon emissions to slow warming. But for now, climate change is already here. And Yang says Alaskans are shouldering the bill. In Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
High mortgage rates are still battering the housing market. I'm Novosapo with the Marketplace Minute. Existing home sales fell 2% between August and September. They're down 15% compared to a year ago. But the National Association of Realtors says median home prices rose thanks to low inventories. For the first time since January, initial claims for unemployment benefits fell below 200,000 last week, decreasing by 13,000 compared to the week prior. Jobless claims have been mostly on a downward trajectory since peaking in June. The European Union is asking social media companies how they are containing violent content, hate speech, and disinformation connected to the Israel-Hamas war. European regulators have sent more official requests for information to Meta and TikTok. I'm Novosapo with a Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Thursday. It is the 19th day of October, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 8:53. It will set again at 6:54. That will give us 10 hours and 1 minute of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 51 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 59 degrees, set in 1929, and our record low was 22 degrees, set in 1915, and then again in 1916. Currently 51 degrees, under a few clouds, north winds from 9 to 9 miles per hour at the airport where they have 10 miles of visibility. Partly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon are expected with a high near 49, northwest winds 10 to 15. For tonight, mostly cloudy skies. For tomorrow, mostly cloudy skies. 20% chance of rain tonight, 30% chance of rain tomorrow, overnight low of 38. Calm winds turning to the southeast tonight and then back to the northeast tomorrow. Starting on Saturday, sunny skies, mostly sunny for Sunday and Monday, partly sunny for Tuesday and Wednesday. Looking at our local tides, we have an incoming tide. Our next high tide will be at 4:59 here on the east side, call it 5 p.m. That will be a 9.3-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 12:01 a.m., call that midnight, of 2/10. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 5:28 p.m. That will be a 14-foot tide in Larson Bay, followed by a low tide at 12:19 a.m. tonight of 0 feet. Mariners, here is your weather forecast from Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory today with west winds to 25 knots should diminish to 15 knots this afternoon. 6-foot seas coming down to 4 feet this afternoon. And for tomorrow, northeast 15, seas to 3 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory for today, southwest 25, becoming northwest 20 this afternoon. 6-foot seas coming down to 4 feet after midnight. For tomorrow, northeast 20 and seas to 5 feet. The Kodiak Kingfisher Swim Club will have an open house this Friday, tomorrow, starting at 5, about 5 to 6:30, in the pool lobby. New families are encouraged to stop in and meet the board members and coaches. They will have information about the club and the schedule for the year. Kingfisher swimming begins November 6th and runs through April 13th. If you'd like to be a part of them, go there on Friday for the open house. Again, that's 5 to 6:30 p.m. in the pool lobby tomorrow. Also tomorrow, Kodiak Elders Coffee and Tea Hour. All Kodiak elders are invited to join them for coffee, tea, and refreshments and a drawing workshop with Janet Bain. Supplies and refreshments are provided and transportation is available for beneficiaries. It's all happening tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. through 12:30 p.m. at the Koniag Conference Area over on Near Island. For more information or to arrange a ride, contact Elder Services at 907-486-7352. Lots of fun family things happening this weekend, including the Kodiak High School Shakespeare's performance of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Four performances this weekend, Friday at 7 p.m., Saturday at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m., and Sunday at 2 p.m. It's all happening at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. Bring the family and come watch this fantasy classic. You can get tickets at kodiakshakespeare's.ludus.com or just get them at the door. Again, that's 7 p.m. Friday, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. Saturday, and 2 p.m. Sunday at the Gerald C. Also this Saturday, the pumpkin patch and sale is going on at the fairgrounds. The Kodiak 4-H is presenting the pumpkin patch plus a bake sale and the opportunity to take fall photos. That's all happening at the fairgrounds starting at 12 o'clock and scheduled to go through 2 p.m. Free admission, cash or check for pumpkins, please. And all other activities are by donation. That's brought to you by Mattson 4-H and the Kodiak Rodeo State Fairground. Also happening on Saturday, the U.S. Coast Guard Fire Station is hosting a open house. All of the fire people from around Kodiak will be there. They want you to join them. That's happening Saturday, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the U.S. Coast Guard Fire Station. And they're going to have lots of great stuff for the kids, bounce houses, food, fire truck display, meet and greet with Sparky, and learning activities and games. Fun for the whole family. Starting at 10 a.m. at the U.S. Coast Guard Fire Station on Saturday. Kids love fire trucks. The Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be meeting tonight at 6:30 p.m. That's happening in the Assembly Chambers. On October 24th, the Parks and Recreation Committee will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Conference Room at 11 a.m. Planning for Life's Changes. Kodiak College is hosting a four-part series in partnership with Hospice and Palliative Care of Kodiak. That's happening Tuesday, November 7th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Kodiak College, BBB Room 128. In session one, learn from a panel of experts in the field who will help you understand the importance of advanced healthcare directive, a durable power of attorney, and a will. And they'll share local resources that are available. Ages 18 to 108 are welcome. And again, that's 6 to 8 p.m., Tuesday, November 7th, at the Kodiak College, room 128. And don't forget the Stiles Clark auction is this weekend, too. Doors open at 5, dinner served at 5:30, and a cash bar till 10 p.m.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day. Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.